is I'm going to go through some of this sort of theory around urban theology and missional church with you. I'm going to skip out the missional church piece because I'm assuming that most of you have had that conversation before. But I'm going to put some energy into the urban theology piece with you. And then talk about how we respond to that in terms of the neighborhood that I'm in. And then Graham's here, and Graham's involved in one of the ministries that we've planted within that context. So that's where we're going to. I'm an urban anthropologist, which means that I study urban change, but I'm also a cleric. And so my fascination with urban theology is to see how urban theology is engaged. And in a sense, what happened in the 1970s is urban theology put a lot of energy into the urban poor and dealing with the urban poor, and primarily because it came and developed in large North American cities like Chicago. And so the obsession was with the inner city and the inner city blight and all those sorts of things. But what began to happen to urban theology is that, in a sense, it sort of wrote itself out of the script at the end of the day. And so there's this reinvigoration around urban theology, particularly in terms of church growth and the conversation around fresh expressions of church, and how would we respond to a changing urban context in which we find ourselves in. And there are a couple of things that have happened that have facilitated that conversation. The first is that we've had the deindustrialization of many cities, both in Europe and in North America. Toronto is a classic example of a deindustrialized city. If you go south of us on the lakeshore, and even just in actual fact, a block south of us, we were in the heart of a highly industrialized context. We're in the milling area where a lot of clothing was made and all those sorts of things. And now we're actually in an area with light industry, high-tech industries, the entertainment district, a lot of financial sector, all those sorts of things. So we're in the heart of that deindustrialized context in which has taken place in Toronto. Some of you may not be aware, but one of the biggest, or the biggest that's rumored, mouse-rat colony in North America is literally two blocks north of where St. George the Martyr is. It's a massive big science lab, and there are all these moths living in the third and the fourth story below ground for scientific lab testing. But that's an indication of the sort of era we're in. There's this massive professionalization, high-tech industries that are emerging around there. But that's sort of the face of the new Toronto. The other is that we're part of a regenerated city. And so what's begun to happen is people investing money in trying to neaten up Toronto. We're about 10 years behind Chicago at least, if not more than that. But nonetheless, Toronto's trying to catch up with itself and become a regenerated city. I used to work in the City of London before in England, and it went through regeneration about 20 years ago. But it's really this process of reinvestment in mixed economic use of land, new developments and all those sorts of things. And what it is that people choose to live in the urban context, but they want the comforts and the pleasure of living in an inner city area. Toronto is also becoming a gentrified city. Gentrification is where you take historical buildings and you reimagine them in terms of their history, and then you reinvest in them as a sort of a cultural capital. And so in the area that I'm in, most of the buildings were built in the Victorian era. The church that I'm in was built in 1844. There's a sense of aspiration to recover some of the history of the space. It's an interesting thing to do because we live in a postmodern society where people are profoundly historically dislocated. And we're in this historical building, and there's this aspiration to become historically located in some way. But what's important to us is the fact that when gentrification takes place, you actually have a decrease in population in gentrified areas. And we have pockets of historical housing which used to be communal housing or shared housing, and the minute you gentrify them, you move in a set of dinkies into them, dual-income couple, and you automatically, reduce the population of a given area. So some of the pockets we're in, we're seeing these young professionals moving in and older professionals moving in and gentrifying the houses. And so the population has been going down as well. Toronto is a multicultural city. It's one of the most multicultural cities in the world. But there's a sense of life choice that people want to live in a historical multicultural city, and they aspire to do so. And so they move into areas like our own, which has a strong sense of history, but there's a strong sense of cultural diversity. We're part of Chinatown, borders on us. It's part of our life. There's a very strong Jamaican presence in our context as well. There's a Ukrainian church just north of us. So we're right in the heart of this sort of cultural milieu, as it were, within the inner city. And then finally, we've seen the suburbanization of urban space. So as more people move into a regenerated area, what they do is they bring their urban values, their suburban values with them. So some of the old warehouses have been converted into box stores, basically. So you can still have the box store experience, but live in the inner city. And that's part of the culture that will come with it. One of the interesting statistics for Toronto, at any rate, about 10 years ago, the city did surveys on transport use. If you live in the sort of 401 area, about 70% of the population use public transit to get around, and about 30% use cars. Once you're outside of the 401, beyond the 401, basically the statistics reverse themselves. About 70% of the population are car users. Hence the need for a parking lot at your church if you're in suburbia. And in our context, a parking lot is a handy thing, but most people don't drive. Most people come in. But what has happened with the suburbanization of urban context is we're finding more people having access to cars and will commute and choose to do so. And that also shapes the nature of church that we're involved in. So what we've seen is really it's what I'd call a smorgasbord of change. That's happened within our context. And we're really at the heart of that. Most of the churches that we have as Anglicans in the inner city of Toronto have gone through significant decline over the last 15, 20 years. And part of it is that they've struggled to engage with that changing culture, that changing cultural framework. So part of my agenda and our agenda at St. George the Martyr is to find ways to re-engage ourselves. And to do that, we've argued that mixed economy church is the best way. I'm going to give all of that a skip because it's just there. But what's important to us here is part of the larger cultural process that we've gone through is this sort of postmodern, post-religious worldview that's developed around us. And if you look statistically at an area that I'm in, close to about 50% of the population have no religious affiliation, obvious religious affiliation. They're a profoundly post-religious community, by and large. And so one of the issues that we're having to face is how do you engage with a post-religious world, and what does that mean? But at the same time, we've also experienced the possibility that new immigrants provide a vibrancy to the church that we can tap into. This became evident in cities like London, most probably about 15, 20 years ago. More than half of all Anglicans now in the city of London are new immigrants. So if you go to South London, for example, there's massive big Nigerian Anglican congregations or Tamil Anglican congregations. And what they've done is they've moved into the cities, these new regenerated cities, and they've brought faith with them. And the question is, to what extent is that true here within the context in which we find ourselves? To say that I'm one of those people would be an understatement. Okay, is that I don't come from a postmodern, post-Christian society. I come from a profoundly religious society, postmodern nonetheless. So statistically, if we just looked at across the board for the census information for the last 20 years, St. George the Martyr, in the 80s, 6% of the local population would have regarded themselves as Anglican in any way. And you know that that means that they were putting on the form that they're Anglican, whether they went to church or not is another story. But by 2001, that was only 4% of the local population would regard itself as Anglican in any form or other. Being an Anglican church in the inner city, what does that mean? It means that the pool of people we're drawing on is really small, which would work at about 528 people. In 81, of our local population who would have had any sense of affiliation to the Anglican Church. Never mind bother to come. But what's also important at the same time, in contrast, by 2001, 42% of the population would have said that they were post-religious or non-religious. And so part of the conversation we're having is exploring that, is what do they mean by non-religious? And there's a good argument to suggest that they might be people of faith, but who have no religious affiliation. Or they're people who perceive themselves as profoundly spiritual, but don't necessarily identify with institutionalized expressions of faith. And so some of what we've been doing has begun to tap into that section of the population. One of our objectives is to do primary evangelism. I'm not a great believer in transferred growth. in the sense that I start my church here and it looks better than your church next door, so your people come to me. That's not a healthy model of church planting, even though a lot of us do it. But I am a great believer in attracting the disaffected. In other words, people who've become deinstitutionalized in terms of the church, but are still seeking some sort of relationship with a faith community within that. But I'm also a great believer in primary evangelism, that we need to do a lot more primary evangelism, and there's tons of scope to do it in, and particularly in my context. I'm going to skip all of that. That's all about missional theology. Okay. But what's key to us is that the contemporary city is a complex place. So those of you involved in urban ministry, what you would realize now is that at one time, if you did urban ministry, you were either dealing with the poor or you were dealing with the rich. There was a far more pronounced sense that there was this capacity out there to do something. Regeneration creates a complexity to it where you have the rich and the poor living cheek to jowl. And what it creates in our context is a very complex demographic that becomes increasingly difficult to respond to on some levels. And so what we're doing is we're trying to engage that complexity. And what we've realized is that you can't do church one size fits all any longer. What you have to be able to do is you've got to be able to imagine that the faith community that affiliates itself to a particular place will be profoundly diverse, and their needs will be profoundly diverse, and that our engagement needs to be profoundly diverse as well. And for us, there's some key factors that I think that help us. One is we have the appeal of the historical architecture on our side. Our church was built in 1844. The main sanctuary burnt down in 1955, but we now meet in a schoolhouse, which was built in 1846. It's a beautiful old building. It's just really usable. We have an 8-bedroom rectory, which was also built in 1846, I think, and it's just this humongous building. You can seat 100 people on the ground floor, basically. It only has 3 rooms on the ground floor. The lounge, which seats 120 people, and a small little anteroom, which seats about, we could maybe get about 30 people around a table in there, and then this big farm-style kitchen. That's the ground floor. And then 8 bedrooms above it. So we have that sort of historical location and space to draw on. We're part of the pedestrian landscape. John Street is being designated a pedestrian thoroughfare at some point in the future, and we're at the bottom end of the Grange, which is this massive big parkland. And so we have a lot of pedestrian traffic that comes through us and past us constantly. We have a garden, a cloistered garden, and it becomes part of the pedestrian landscape. We just have tons of people who come and sit in there during the day and just relax and unwind from there. We are in the heart of the media community. Our website is down at the moment, which tells you about how much we value media. No, we're in the heart of this media community. And part of the engagement is to say, well, how do we do media stuff? How do we communicate who we are? We're also in a place where there's a high level of spirituality. And so what we're beginning to engage with is, how do you offer spirituality within a Christian framework? How do you offer a dialogue that involves the person of Christ within that? We're also trying to engage in that dichotomy of being contemporary and historical all at once. People in postmodern society want to be historically rooted, but they also are modern people. So they want all the trappings that go with it as well. And so part of the dilemma is, how do you do that and how do you articulate that? We host an organization called the Music Gallery. They organize 4 or 5 events a week, which involve emerging music from a whole range, from jazz to rock to classical music to really alternative stuff that's like really off the wall. And they use our main sanctuary to do that in. And so there's this massive smudging that happens between the secular and sacred in our space constantly. And then we're beginning to explore forms of social outreach that put a greater emphasis on the relationship element. We have at least 6 homeless people who sleep on our site constantly. They just change all the time. One family left yesterday, and I know that I'll go there tomorrow and there'll be a new crowd of people there. But we try to limit it to 4. People, we actually go out and say, look, we can only allow 4 of you to sleep on site this week, or whatever it is. But there's a sense in which we don't want to just offer services, but we actually want to engage in relationship with the needy as well within our community. We're also in the heart of a cluster of social housing as well. So if you come to St. George the Martyr on an average Sunday, you will have people sitting there who live in multi-million dollar houses on Beverly Street, two blocks away from us, as well as somebody coming in with a shopping trolley off the street. And so we have regular worshippers who are street people as part of our congregation, and everybody in between that. So what was our vision when we started? I've only been there for 9 months, so let me just tell you that now, okay? So you get a sense of how fresh this is. But our vision was to establish and plant a healthy, dynamic, and culturally engaged worshiping community in the heart of the downtown core that is strongly missional, in other words, outward-looking, but within an Anglican framework. We are Anglicans, and that's part of our identity, that's part of our liturgy, that's part of who we are, and so we're constantly working through that lens. And secondly, to be self-sustaining, multi-staffed, program-sized church that focuses on team ministry. Our diocesan policy is that 70% of our income or 75% of our income should come from the congregation itself. And that would be a self-sustaining parish in our context. And so the goal is to get there, is to be affordable and to be able to sustain what we do in the ministry we do financially. We can't be dependent upon others to fund us forever. We want to be multi-staffed. In my context, it's impossible to be a lone priest. It just doesn't work. I don't think it works anywhere else, does it, Father? But the reality is that in our context, most of my time could be taken up just doing two Sunday morning services and dealing with the pastoral needs of those congregations. But that's not sustainable. And so the only way we can address that is by actually recruiting more staff and paying for more staff who can do all the add-ons. My assistant, she's only 10 hours a week, but she's been off sick for the last few months, which has meant that I've had to sideline all of my other work in order just to deal with Sunday mornings and get through Sunday mornings. I've had the joy of having 5 students come work for me for the last 9 months, and they're the ones who actually get the dog work done at the end of the day in terms of the fresh expression stuff. And then ultimately, we need to be a program-sized church. So our goal is to, at the end of the day, is to have somewhere in the region about 250 people as active participants in the life of that community every week. That's our goal. Now, we only have a sanctuary that holds about 150 people. But our intention isn't to plant a full-size church of that nature, but rather to plant many communities that all interrelate to each other and so become a mixed economy church on the basis that one size does not fit all, and we'll have to spread our appeal out in terms of who comes in. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we've done over these last few months so you get a sense of what we're up to. When I arrived in September, I had 4 parishioners at the 9 o'clock service, and I had, I think, 34 people or something at our 10:30 service. That was welcome to the fall. The congregation had been through significant decline. It had declined from about 120, 130 people over a 10-year period to that. And that was it. That's what I arrived on Sunday mornings. That was my deal. When we had the gospel, in an Anglican tradition, for those of you who are not from an Anglican tradition, we have a gospel procession, and you stand in the middle of the church and read the gospel. The joy for me was the first Sunday morning at 9 o'clock, there was me, 2 people with gospel candles, the person holding the gospel, and 1 listener. That was my 9 o'clock. Okay, so that's what I looked at. It was the first Sunday morning I was there. And I thought, this is going to be fascinating, being part of this. When I got to 10:30, thankfully there were more than 30 people, and there was a bit of a dynamism to that possibility. But within a week I realized, there are a lot of people out here. My first day was a Wednesday. I met 10 new people just by going into the church garden. And every time somebody walked in the garden, I went out and I greeted them and just got to know people and started walking the area. And then one day a group of students came to me and said, "We're from OCAD, the Ontario College of Art and Design. Do you mind if we use your building for our Bible study group?" And out of that has grown a relationship with most probably about 40 students from OCAD and UFT, and a partnership with InterVarsity. So we now hold 3 student Bible study groups in our facilities in the rectory. They've been involved in community cleanup projects and things with us as well as we've gone on from there. And we've just had a month of 20 of them living in our rectory and doing an urban mission project with us. I then registered for the Mission Shaped Ministry course at Wycliffe, and out of that I got four students. The first student was Sam, who is a student from Emmanuel College. And during Advent, what she did was we did four artists coming in one Sunday of Advent each, did a single painting with four panels or three panels in it, because two of them did one panel. And then in Lent, we did eight artists doing six crosses. And what we're in the heart of the arts community, and we wanted to find out whether artists would be interested in coming into our space and participating with us in creating liturgy. And they were. And so these aren't artist display, they're actually artist participation, in the sense that the crosses, for example, came out of the community prayers on each given Sunday. And then the following Sunday, the artists would come back with a cross as a piece of art and present the prayers back to the people in that level. One of the most creative crosses out of all of these is a guitar. And we gave them standard crosses, they're about this yay high, and they were just basically pine crosses. And two of these artists created a guitar with six strings each on each side and a bass guitar down the middle. They composed a piece of music to go with it and came back and played this piece of music and said the congregation's prayers over the music. It was just incredibly invigorating. I think it was the most profound moment I've had of all those crosses, was that particular moment. And out of that have come a series of collaborative projects around art and our community. And so one of the things that we are looking at is six artists are moving into the rectory and setting up an intentional community that will explore spirituality and the arts as a result of that, particularly the visual arts. And so all of those artists participated in the crosses. All of them are people of faith in various levels, and most of them are from the L'Arche community. So out of that, we actually picked up 10 new parishioners, basically, who are now regular worshippers with us, including residents of various L'Arche communities who've come along with them. And that's added a whole dimension of activity to our lives. Yeah. Then the second experiment we tried was over Advent. I did an Advent series where I looked at what does Christmas really mean, and with reflective moments. We were building on the fact that the parish had been a center of spirituality for a long time, had explored Ignatian spirituality. And then one of the students, Karen MacDonald, who is also on our board, did a thing called Journey to Prayer, where she experimented with Celtic spirituality. It didn't work. Neither of them worked. And within 3 months, we knew it was just a no-go. And so we literally just terminated them. But what it showed us was, out of all of that, there was this enormous need for isolated and disaffected Christians to have a community that they could engage with for their own discipleship. And so people came approaching us and saying, well, we're not interested in this, but we are interested in something else. And so out of that, we've just started a whole process of Christian education and Christian formation, regular Bible study groups, and stuff like that. And that's been a key learner for us. Graham, experiment 5.
For experiment 5, Jeff and I, we were thinking, in England they've done stuff called Night Church. There are videos on that. So it's the opportunity for a worship space to be open for people in club districts, in where people are bored, addicted, in a place of light that the gospel talks about, that we are the light. And yet at night the church goes to sleep. And so we thought, what's better place for the church to be than at night? So we explored the area. We walked around for consecutive weekends over a couple months to talk to people, asked what their patterns of life were, what they did on a Friday night, what they did on a Saturday night. And we found out that the church was just too far away from the entertainment district. Even though it was just a block away, we needed a storefront. And both Jeff and I are married, and Jeff has kids and just can't afford that on student budgets. And so what we did, we got to praying and discerning, and at this time Simon put us in touch with the Music Gallery, who he mentioned, who is this collective of this NGO that puts on music performances. And we said, well, God must be bringing these people into the church for a reason. They'd been there for 8 years and had never had a connection made between the congregation and this group. And so we thought, well, what's the best way that we can do that? Is we can offer them hospitality. Beginning with hospitality, we offer them dinners after their concerts on a semi-regular basis. The idea behind it is we don't want to impose a liturgical form. We don't want to impose any overt structures. Part of it because we're both students and not affiliated with the congregation, so we don't want to lose a renter for St. George the Martyr because we didn't want to lose that for Simon. But part of it is also we wanted it to be an authentic community gathering. So we bless the meal, and then we engage in conversation. We've had about 5 or 6 nights so far since February. And what we do is we after the meal, we bless it, and we talk. And so at our very last night, which is a couple weeks ago, was probably our most fruitful to some degree, is that I had a conversation with a couple about spirituality, about it was Deepak Chopra and how that related to Jesus and stuff. And while that might not seem like, you know, that might seem like baby steps, for us that was a big deal to get anyone talking about faith, and we were able to talk about the church and what we were doing. And so our hope is that it can we can make intentional relationships with a group that's already there, and maybe something will blossom because we do know God is already there with them. So that's part of what we're doing. So.
And out of that, for myself as well, we developed a number of pastoral relationships, including having done a funeral for one of the patrons of the art gallery, or the music gallery, those sorts of things. And I think it's making that connection and working on it, and hopefully that'll network into something else from there. The two further conversations we're having at the moment, the first is planting a young adults congregation on a Sunday evening. We're in the right demographic for it. We've been approached by a number of other denominations to use our building to do that with. So we thought, well, why get somebody else to come and do it when we could do it ourselves? And let's go ahead and just simply get it done. So that'll be one of the key projects coming up in the fall. And then the other project we're exploring is a project that came out of York Diocese in England called Minimass, and it was a project I was involved in when I lived in England as well, in Devon. And that is really using an Anglican liturgical framework around the Eucharist and inviting people into it who are not necessarily from a Christian cultural background, but who are looking for ritual, mystery, and a sense of engagement in a liturgical moment. From there, it's really geared to adults, but it incorporates children. It's sort of like Messy Church, but the other way up. Messy Church appeals to children, and you aim it at children, and you accommodate adults. Whereas Mini Mass, you aim it at adults, and you incorporate children. So, and just because of the demographics we're in, we feel it would work a lot better. What have I learned? That's where I ended last time. Just three things I think that in terms of what we've learned so far. Doing mixed economy church is really tiring and very demanding because you're having to do so much at once. I mean, if you just look at the range of things we're doing and the range of things we've got planned, it's really hard to work out what to do and when to do it and how to prioritize what you do. But we've had to do that. We've had to really be very careful about what we take on to make sure it's authentic to the context which we're in. And at the same time, we've had to really engage around trying to find the resources to do it well. We can't do everything, but we can do something. And what we do, we want to offer something that people want to come back to on so many levels. So that's been a key learning for us. And for me, as the priest in charge of the parish, I've had to learn that I can't do everything, I can't be at everything, and I can't engage in everything. But my job is really to facilitate the ministry of others and to give permission. It is a Father Knows Best parish, by and large, and people call me Father Simon. They won't make decisions unless I make the decision, all those sorts of things. So it's engaging, it's capitalizing on that, but also learning that, in actual fact, I've got to free people up from that culture of Father Knows Best on some level or other. And that's been a real learning process for me. The second is that it requires staff. And in our case, I could spend my entire life just trying to grow my 9 o'clock and 10:30 service. Two Sundays ago, we had 80 people at our 10:30 service. And on average now, both services, we're on a regular basis now, we're getting more than 60 people on a regular basis. And that's been a major encouragement for us. Our giving has gone up, I think, by 42% in 9 months from what it was when I first came. So we've seen a phenomenal amount of growth over the last few months. But in order to sustain that and keep it going, we need the staff to make it happen. One of the mistakes I think we make and I think in our context we make it profoundly, is that sometimes we think that we should be training people up to just do messy church or to do heritage church, and that's garbage. I think those of us involved in heritage church need to learn to do messy church and spread our wings a bit and do mixed economy church and all those things. But I think for people to do mixed economy church well, you need to know where you've come from. You have to have a really good grasp of what it is that you're doing. Because at the end of the day, we have to do both well. And in the context in which I find myself in, I've got to be able to stand up there and do a standard-led liturgy at 9 o'clock that's interesting, dynamic, and engaging, and is part of a tractional church, as much as I need to be able to walk in on a Friday night with Graham and Jeff and hang out with a whole lot of people and talk about music and spirituality. That the whole range of possibilities is there. And so for our clergy, and we're talking about clergy training, I'm involved in that conversation in our diocese, is we're having to train people who can do everything all at once. Now, I realize that, if you're classically in church planting, what you do is you find somebody who's an entrepreneur, you train them, you send them out, 5 years they've planted a church, and then you move them on, and you find somebody else who can actually keep the thing going. Messy church doesn't work that way. You just can't do it like that. You actually have to be able to do all of it at once. So all of our staff preach on a regular basis. All of our staff are involved liturgically on a regular basis. And that's the expectation. And that all of us can actually do something other. But with the recognition that we have specializations within that. So our goal within the next 2 years would end up with 4 people on our staff. 3 of them will be part-time and then myself full-time. But those part-time folk will then bring in their specializations into the conversation on some level or other. Within that. And then, what was I going to do? Finally, yeah, the final piece is we've been gifted as an Anglican church by the fact that we have so many buildings in the inner city. Now, that can be a burden to us, and we can say, well, shucks, we should have sold them long ago, and we should have moved out to the suburbs like everybody else did, and given up on the inner city. But what I'm learning from my other colleagues from the Salvation Army and Baptists and Alliance Church is that to come back into the city can cost you $15, $20 million. We have the real estate, tons of it. And for $1 million, we can reinvigorate that landscape. We can reimagine church. We can engage in all sorts of things. It's a cheap option. And so by and large, I think what we're doing is we're saying, well, we have all of these buildings, all these facilities, and these slowly dwindling congregations. How do we re-engage them? And I think part of it is we just missed the demographic boat. That's really what happened about 20 years ago. And so part of the job that we have is to do both attractional historical church well, but also to be able to plant dynamic, interesting, formative forms of fresh expression at the same time. And so that's really where we're going. We're in the process now of putting together a 7-year budget and proposal. For funding for the place, and within that is the understanding that that's where we're going to in the long haul. So you'll still arrive at a 10:30 sung Eucharist on a Sunday morning and enjoy it for what it is, church as it used to be at some level, but attractive, as well as coming into something pretty off the wall and odd on a Saturday night sort of process. But that's really where we are now. Okay, questions, responses? Ideas. I realize it's just after lunch and your brain is sucking blood madly out of your stomach.
Well, you mentioned you have an interesting demographic. You refer to it as a post-religious demographic. Do you have any intentional activities in terms of other religious groups?
Our bookkeeper is a Muslim. The church's bookkeeper is a Muslim. But he's a cultural Muslim who came to faith. He was actually baptized in Liverpool, amazingly enough. But he arrived here as a refugee. And so we're having some conversations with people who are on the edges of other religious communities who are fascinated by our faith. And part of that conversation is that we've realized that there are a lot of people out there who might have strong religious backgrounds but became disaffected because of their ethics. And so they're looking for a space that they can engage in a conversation around faith that is ethically open, and which we are. And so I think what's happening is we begin to attract people like that. We've got a new parishioner, well, somebody who's attending. She's from a Muslim-Hindu parentage. Her child's father is Jewish, and she lives a block away from the church. And she started coming to St. George the Martyr because she wanted somewhere for her child to grow up in faith. She'd never been to a church before in her life. She didn't know what a church was. She walked in at during our 9 o'clock, which is a sad Eucharistic prayer service, and walked in at 9 o'clock and asked me about what was going on. And then she's been 2 Sundays in a row to our 10:30 service, which is more musically orientated and geared towards folk on that basis. But I think there's a conversation that we're having that's broader than that in terms of folk who are fascinated by who we are as a community. So I think it comes out in that form. I mean, we're not involved in interfaith dialogue or any of those sorts of things, explicitly so. We have a fairly healthy relationship with the Jewish community around us. I mean, that's been an ongoing one. That predates me a long way. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about the scarf issue.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is the model you describe is a very sort of classic contemporary evangelical approach to suburban churches. And I'm wondering if you could just unpack why that is. I mean, I can understand, obviously, particularly in a situation where we restart the church, we move it. But in the wider scheme of things, is that a state you think will continue as necessary? And why? Given historically you have a one priest for perhaps even 500 people, only 50 years ago.
Yeah.
But what's different? Is it to do with the people unwilling to commit time, or do they have the time as volunteers, or their demands are different?
Well, first thing I think that we need to recognize is that ministry's changed. That ministry is a lot more relational now. I have one particular, I was just joking with somebody now, I'm involved in a pastoral counseling process with somebody by email. They live a block away from the church, but they won't come and see me and talk about themselves. But they're happy to give me the entire life history on my BlackBerry. This takes time and energy. And they email me 3 or 4 times a day, and you have to ask yourself, at what point do you stop responding? But I think the question of how we use our time has shifted. The neighborhood priest who did the beat is still an aspiration of mine. I think from the Anglo-Catholic tradition, where we had clergy who just walked the neighborhood. There is something of that still, and it's desirable. But we need to remember that we don't live in Christendom where people just came to church irrespective. So I think that's the key bit for me in terms of time allocation. The amount of energy we have to put into those relationships in order to make the ministry work is really high. And if we just took Graham and Jeff's project, for example, each of them was putting in 10 hours a week. In those 10 hours a week, how much of it was spent developing really good, healthy relationships with the people who came? Very little. Now we could employ a Graham full time just to do that project. I mean, we need to employ a Graham full time to do that project. So that you actually develop healthy pastoral relationships with the people who come, and then out of that plant a new community of faith. And so a lot of the work that was done, for example, by Pete Ward in England with youth ministry and detached youth ministry demonstrated that to be true. You work with 5 or 8 people slowly, because you're doing primary evangelism. And so there's this constant conversation that you're having, theological conversation you're having, that's this ongoing journey of faith. And then you grow a community that's authentic to who they are. We were joking the other day, 50 years ago, we sent missionaries to Japan, or 100 years ago, they went for life. There was a commitment they made. There were new graduates of Wycliffe, and off they went to Japan. And that was it. They knew they were going to plug away with 20 people for the rest of their life.
That's ordination.
Pardon?
Ordination.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was the commitment they made.
It happens all the time. Sister Cecilia Vincent DePaul just were talking about their history.
Yeah.
They sent their their sisters down from Montreal.
Yeah.
They ended up not meeting there. They went up and stopped somewhere and stayed.
Yeah. But we would have to think like that again. So the contemporary church as it exists now, in a post-Christian society, has to think of itself in that missional sense. is that we have to invest large amounts of time and energy as individuals in an ongoing pastoral relationship with somebody. So that changes the nature in which we will do things.
I mean, there's just an issue about this, kind of the goal of the mission and the issue of discipleship and the issue that the making disciples makes people make disciples. And so the idea is that the ministry turns over to those.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I mean, is there some of the danger that by relying on paid staff that you never get that?
Yeah, I think what Fresh Expressions in England taught us is that most Fresh Expressions in England are sold by lay people. But the problem is they don't grow. They reach a point where you can only deal with so many people at a time. And then the question is, you know, if you have one of my parishioners, I asked her to sit down, she's going to be involved in one of the church plants we're doing. I asked her to sit down and work out how much time she could give us a month. She's a busy executive, you know, banking industry. She could offer us 5 hours a month of her time. And this is somebody sitting down with a calendar and actually working out how much time she had left per week that she could offer to anything. And it was 5 hours a month. Now, when you're living like that, which a lot of our young professionals in our community are living like that constantly, you have to ask yourself, well, how does this become sustainable? If she got involved in, which she's going to do in mini mass, and that's her investment, how much can I expect out of me 5 hours a month? Not a lot. So what it means is that I have to be the one who has to do the dog work, and she's the one who's doing filler. And so what happens is that we, as the clergy, don't become the ones who are trying to do everything ourselves. We enable the ministry of others, but we're the ones who actually have to do the legwork to make it possible. And I think that's where the investment comes. I've worked in suburban baby church before, you know, as a professional youth worker, all that sort of stuff. It's not that at all. There is an attractional model of church. You want to get 50 kids in a room, so you employ somebody to do it. And it's program-based, it's program-driven. This form of ministry is not program-based, it's not program-driven. As much as we come up with 50 ideas, the idea is it's relational. And therefore, you have to invest time and energy in those relationships. Where it adds up for lay people is that most of them have relationships at work or at home or in the neighborhood. And it's those connections that become more significant. So, for example, this particular pastoral relationship that I'm working through now with somebody, already that person said, you know, this is a really nice church, you should go there, this pastor spends time with you, you're willing to invest energy, but then you end up with 5 new people who place the same amount of requests on you for their time, and then, you know, I've got to farm it out in other ways. But I think that's part of that process. And my sense is that it only becomes sustainable the longer because we can do it. The other way to answer that question is to look at it in terms of skill sets. I cannot even draw a straight line, never mind come up with an artistic piece of work. I'm ministering in the heart of the arts community. So what do? I find somebody who can. And so, for example, we have Sam around now. And she's a brilliant artist in her own right. And she's engaged in the arts community. She has all these connections. And what I do, I invest resources into her to get her to get fun and do the job and network for me and create the conversations. If you asked me to do something on faith and art and the history of art, I wouldn't even know where to start. It'd be a complete loss. But in our community, you have to be able to do that. The same would be true of the music community. It's finding somebody who can latch into the music community and have those conversations. So whatever form we do, that's what we have to look at on that level. Is there another question? Yes.
One of the hurdles I see is that one thing I admire about the Anglican leadership is their commitment to it and to embrace a mixed economy church. One of the problems I see is trying to get a church like my church to embrace it. And we have a different type of structure in that we're a Presbyterian church, we don't have a bishop. So we have to get more people online to do more things. Where I see this model applying, I'm from London, so maybe you can get some help from students in London. But I can see this taking flight in enabling and empowering lay people who have skills that are professional people who are already doing professional jobs. And I think one thing that the church itself, the traditional church, has lost that role roll up its sleeves and do things in the community type of atmosphere where they're always doing positive things. And I looked at writing a paper for what we do with the traditional church. Well, my where I came up was, you have to start having more barbecues. You have to start doing things in the community to help the community, that you can invite people along, meet you in a different context.
Yeah.
And that becomes what you're saying, that becomes that relational context.
Yes. Yeah, and I think what we're doing is authentic to where we're at. And there are other things that other people could do that are authentic to the context that they find themselves in. Like we have community barbecues as well, and it's one of the things that our church has done for a long time. The problem is they never made the connection between the community barbecues and what happened on a Sunday morning. And so often what happens is I go to churches that are doing interesting things, and I used to work as a consultant to one of the bishops, and I visit churches and go, that's an amazing project. But there's no connection between what they do there and their worshipping life. And so part of, for me, the dynamic of Mixed Economy Church is constantly creating those connections and rooting it back into our worshipping life as a community. Because ultimately it's that worshipping life as a community that gives you the sense of being sent, but it's also the sense of being drawn back in again. So that's a sort of two-way process that happens.
It comes across from your presentation, from what you said, that you take patience in doing that as well. You don't try to force everyone back. That you develop the right, which I find is the very interesting part of the Mixed Economy Church, is coming together at some point.
But I think that the patience is borne out by a sense of respect for somebody and their humanity. Like for the interfaith conversation that you have, I think there's a question of how do I do this with a sense of respect and dignity for who you are as a human being, recognizing where you've come, acknowledging the value of who you are as a human, but engaging somebody in a conversation which might bring into a different understanding of who they are as a human being. I think that's part of that conversation that I'm involved in. But that takes patience and time. And it's that constant reinforcing that I'm not here just to simply have converts sitting on a bench, but I'm here because I'm interested in you as a human being. And I'm interested in your conversation of faith and your story of faith. And so that's really, I think, the key to where we take any of these things. Like, for example, the music gallery project we have on now, people won't come to those things if they know that all we're going to do is just, you know, shove the Bible down their throat. They will come because they can engage in a conversation that respects their humanity and respects their experience of life, and that's the difference. But that takes time and a lot of work on our part. And if somebody comes to faith a lot, is that the key measure of the quality of what we've done? No. The quality of what we've done is how we've treated them. Jesus' response is, that's right. Yeah, I mean, Jesus says, you'll know my disciples because you love one another, not because 50 of you can get in a room and have a prayer meeting. That's not the, you know, that's the problem with our measure's wrong. And so what we want to do is build into it from the get-go the value set that we want. I think the other thing that we have learned, and just so we come back to Alex's question, one of the things we have learned is and I think we learned this as a diocese, we had conversations with other denominations, and we realized that you get what you plant. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Baptists have done a number of church plants, and a number of them have failed. And the reason being is they have in their imagination one cleric that goes out and builds a building in suburbia or in the inner city somewhere, and you get 120 people, and that's what you end up with. And you just stall, constantly stall at that point, and then it's unsustainable, or it actually kills the ministers. So we found in our own denomination that most clergy would work by themselves in the classic 120 men congregation. They're exhausted because they can't keep it up. They just can't sustain the energy to keep reinvigorating this little thing, which is clawing away at itself. So we had as a policy when I came to this diocese the understanding that we would staff up for growth, that we would try and create team ministries wherever we went. And so this understanding falls within that. Is that team works better because you actually, it's healthier for the staff themselves, it's healthier for the congregation. The folk we learned that from on some levels are the Alliance people. You know, last year they sit down and say, well, where should we plant a church? And they go, here. And they go, okay, how big is it going to be? 1,000 people? 2,500? Then we take somebody, church plant. We put them out there for 5 years, they do it, and the next thing you know, put a staff there. And they're doing their miracle thing. And they're brilliant. They do it really well. Now, you can do that in suburbia, you can't do that in the city. Because they really are doing one size fits all type church, where you have, you know, a 500-seat auditorium and everybody participates in it. And it works to a certain section of the population, but you've got to have a destination church to do that. I.e. people can commute 40 kilometers to come to it. Which in the inner city doesn't work when you've got people who commute on a subway. They're trying to get across the city on a Sunday morning when half the streets are shut for another marathon. It took me half an hour the other day to get to my office and to commute 6 blocks across the city because it was a marathon. I mean, that's the reality. And now I'm the one who's experiencing that, but my parishioners experience that every Sunday. So it's that dynamic too, being in the city.
I thought when you were talking earlier about the difference, I thought, between the traditional how barbecue and invite people, and what you're doing, I'm just reflecting. It strikes me as, in a way, you're inviting people to minister to your people. Like, when you invite Buddhists into the church, you're actually receiving ministry from them as well. Like, it's an understanding of ministry that it's willing to receive ministry from people who, in my traditional thought, we can only minister to. And thank you for that. That's very
good. My basic premise, to tell my leadership this constantly, is that anybody who walks in the door has a ministry gap.
Yeah.
Whether they're people of faith or not is not the question, but God uses them.
Mm-hmm.
And God is involved in their life in some way or other. And therefore, we receive them as ministers among us.
Yeah.
And that they minister to us in some level.
Yeah, that really comes across.
Yeah. And then the reverse is true, is that that's what we do as well. So it is a mutuality. And I think that's why the artists have been really happy to stay, because they're saying they're not just doing art professionally. they're doing something that contributes to the life of a community of faith. And I think that changes their sense of themselves and what they're offering. And that's been a really powerful thing. But you try for that too.
Here's a question. I'm a curate in a downtown parish, which is a cathedral culture. And I'm also struggling trying to find balance to fit into my own age demographic, and I joined a social club where I play volleyball and go for drinks afterwards. Every now and then I'll go and dance at a club, and I tell people I'm a priest, and it's interesting the kind of conversations that come about. And it's like, I almost want to go out and start a ministry where I just go to the clubs and tell people I'm a priest, because it's amazing the amount of
conversation. You're worried about what the bishop will say.
No. Because the moment you invite them to this context of my church, there's nothing there that can fully engage with them, in the sense that they'll come and they'll just see a bunch of traditions, but then they've just finished talking to me, who has opened up the gospel in a new way. And so how do you, in ministry, begin to find ways to meet people's needs? Like, I can't just sit there and say, oh, we need to start up this ministry, like, because I need a place to invite people to church. So how do you find the balance between, and I don't have time to do a year of research to figure out how to plant this when I just keep meeting people and have nowhere to send them.
Yeah. That's really what Mexican Economy's church is about. It's about saying, we have an 9 o'clock service and it really sucks because only 4 people have come, and if I met you on the street, I'd never invite you to it. Because that's the reality. I mean, I wouldn't. Heaven, but because they would go, man, this is everything I dreamed of the church would ever be, and it's true. Yeah, so that's it. I don't say that to my congregation.
It takes time to get to.
Because
it's
all
being recorded.
But what's interesting, by the way, that congregation has grown to 18 people in the time that I've been there. So there are people who will come to that service and engage it because it actually is meaningful to them. So
it's done something different.
What I've done is I've just made it friendly.
Do you know what church?
That's all it is.
Do you know
what
church is?
Yeah.
But I've just worked at making it friendly. Just it's a standard congregational development stuff. Do a traditional church and do it well. You make people feel welcome and part of something. And you do it in a way that's authentic to what you want. And I want to come back to that question because it's important back in my head. Will you just remind me when I finish this one? So I think that's what exactly what the question that Mexican Church asks. And then it says, how do you network with those people that you connect with in a club situation? Now, my curate, Katie, is great at this. She hasn't had much of an opportunity to do it where we are. But, for example, she did a summer placement where she was sent to one of those sort of rural parishes that has a cottage industry around it. And so what she did is she just basically went and met at Tim Hortons or something and started a Bible study group with people. Because she went and said that Tim Hortons, all these people would sit there anyway. And I mean, I've worked in small town Ontario. Tim Hortons is the place to go. You know, you're going to sit there, and 20 people walk in and they sit down at a table and you have a conversation about all sorts of stuff. And so what she did is she just said, well, this is who I am. I'm the local minister for the next 3 months. And they said to her, well, what contribution are you going to make to us? So she said, well, I understand the Bible. Let's have a conversation about that. And out of that began a Bible study group. And it just simply grew. It's still going. I mean, she's left that parish 2 years ago. It still has a life of its own. It's very strongly linked to that parish. Even though they might not be able to go there on a Sunday morning, there's still a discipling, worshiping community that meet in Tim Hortons and study scripture together. But I think that's what faith is about. It's about taking what we are and finding it in other places. The key for me, because I'm an Anglican, is that it has an accountability to it. It is still, I'm the parish priest of St. George the Martyr. I'm the cure of all souls in my parish. Whether they want to be cured or not, it's not a question. But there is an Anglican who has a cure of all souls. It's my job. My job is to find out how to engage people in a faith conversation in a local nightclub or wherever they are in my context. I meet with people in the advertising businesses. They don't come to my church, but there are a whole lot of advertising industries around us. And I have lunch with them.
I collect people at funerals too.
Yeah, that's right. Funerals are another one. Yeah,
they also
well
come to
funerals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's saying, well, how would I begin to engage a faith conversation with you? Pete Boyd is a friend of mine, and he was given £5 million by the Bishop of Oxford to take over the Regent Cathedral at one time, he's not anymore. But anyway, it's like a medieval church building. There's 3 sanctuaries in it. And you can see like thousands of people. He's a pilgrimage church in Reading. And what does he do? He takes kids to movies. So he basically is doing what Graham and Jeff do. You go to something where some other form of media presentation exists. You then have a conversation with them. They involve faith. And out of that, he's planning all these little faith communities of young adults who are involved. This thing is full. That's their thing. So they gather around full conversations and planning these small little communities. But it falls under a jurisdiction and a pastoral responsibility. They're not little float-offs by themselves. But I think that's the key to with it. I think it's just being part of that.
So, I had mentioned that to somebody else. I'm sorry, I just want to ask one more question. Is because I have access to a restaurant where people really like me and knew what my vocation was going to be when I was working there, and they always want me to quit and come back. But I have access to their upstairs part of the restaurant on a dead night.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, why don't I just start doing a study there? And people said, no, you have to plan an experiment.
You do and you don't.
Conversation all the time. Why can't I just formalize it?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I'll
and.
But then, really, it just feels like.
I think you have to take the Prince Harry approach. Bacon buddies. After a night out, bacon buddies. To the bacon make a sandwich. Now, if you've been clubbing, and what do you do at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Where is the balance? Like everybody's the way that the fresh expression movements work is like you got to do this research, demographic, do all this, ask around for a need.
But let's go back to Graham and Jeff's project because I think it's a really helpful case study. We walked around. I mean, they did more walking than I did, but like between 10 at night and 1:30 in the morning, we're in the heart of the entertainment industry. We realize that most things only begin at 10 o'clock at night. So we went around coffee shops and started asking people in coffee shops who comes in. We never met, well, I didn't meet in the time that I walked around, a single person who lived locally. The closest was somebody who lived in Scarborough. It was 2 guys who lived in Scarborough. We met like 20 law people from London, Ontario one night. They come from everywhere but us. But what the businesses told us was this: local people only go out until 9 o'clock at night when they match. And what they were doing is they were coming to places like the music gallery because they were safe, localized networks of people that they could integrate themselves with. If we hadn't done that legwork, we would end up with a storefront project that would just simply bomb out. I mean, that's the honest reflection. Instead, what we ended up with, I think, is a very authentic project that's true to our community, because these guys did the legwork for it. They did, you know, 6 months of hard graft. And I think it paid off in that sense. And it was so obvious. I mean, duh. They're using our building every day. Why don't we just have a conversation with them and ask them what they like to do? And they love it. I mean, they're asking me to do an interview for one of the music magazines for Toronto now on the relationship between the music gallery and St. George the Martyr. Because they're fascinated by what we do. And they've been wanting to have this conversation for years. It was like it was an obvious one. Let's go for it. So I think that the homework and the legwork needs to be done. But there's something as well I think about just simply working out what the pattern is that people would engage in and how you begin to articulate faith with them. Because there are patterns. People have very established patterns. Because we're creatures of habit. And so it's trying to work out what those creatures of habit do all day long and where they feel would be the safest place for them to have a conversation with you. I mean, the bacon butty thing at 6 in the morning, yep. I was involved in a project in Devon where we created a space on Green. This is my 6th church plant, by the way. So I've got a few of my time. But one of the projects we did in Devon, it was a village green. What we found was kids would come out, they would get drunk at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on good Devon cider, they would just basically blast their heads off. And then by 7 o'clock at night, they were fighting with each other. So we created a bandstand on the green, and what we did was we offered soup and hot chocolate and sandwiches on the green. And every night, these kids would just gather and wasp around us because we were the safest space they could be on any given night and still enjoying themselves. And so they would just hang around with us. We didn't have a local constabulary in that little village because it was too small. The nearest one was like 10 miles away from us. So that was their space. We were the local constabulary for them. It was a safe space. And in that space, I could have really good theological conversations with kids because they knew they were safe. They knew it was a safe space. And so I think it's trying to create know where people perceive themselves to be comfortable. I mean, the meals, the hospitality thing is a safe space. It's in the rectory. It's not in the church. We're intentional about that. And it's around a table. And it's very clearly explicit that we are Christians, we have grace, and we're hosting you as a church community. That's what we're doing. But I think people feel safe enough to just come and talk to us. And I think that's what it is.
Captured something there that's really amazing. It's a Sasaki of evangelism. It's interest and concern.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's a way that you can always ask questions.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, but people go, well, how do I start? Well, just talk to them like you talk to anybody else.
Yeah. No, I think that's the key. Go back to your earlier question about our 9 o'clock. Some of you must be aware that most Anglican churches have 8 o'clock service. We don't have 8 o'clock, we have 9 o'clock because of the commuting problem we have. But our 9 o'clock is equivalent to 8 o'clock anywhere else. And the reason I hate it when parishes close down the 8 o'clocks is because they ostracize a whole lot of people who need a quiet, pastoral space where nobody will notice them. And the reason our 9 o'clock has grown is because people can walk in, they can sit down, they can take part in a set service, it's all in the book, they don't have to do anything, and they can get up and walk out before anybody notices them.
I haven't done that. I'm a Presbyterian pastor, right?
Your confessions. So what we're doing is we're just doing that in another form.
Yeah.
We're saying to people, you're welcome here.
Yeah.
And I'd be honest to say that I think most of the people who come to my 9 o'clock, which you know, in that group are people who are just exploring faith. I did a funeral for one of my folk. We arrived at Christmas. It's just done. And Bob came, he was there, he grew up in Anglican, and went to Catholic schools, really avidly at the church. He was in his mid-60s, been in the media industry his entire life. Some people might recognize him because he delivered the summer traffic ride broadcast on Ontario for College Country. And he arrived just before Christmas, sat at the back at 9 o'clock, last pew, and just sat. And he did that for weeks and weeks, just come and sit, just stare at me, and occasionally look at the box and stare at me. Never came forward for communion, nothing. But that was his ritual every Sunday, come to 9 o'clock, never talked to anybody. Then we offered an introduction to ancient history course, or Anglicanism course. And he came to that, he just argued with everybody the whole way through, all 6 weeks. He got to the point of being irritated. But nonetheless, we thought, well, here's a guy already. And what had happened is he began to re-explore faith and connect into faith. He told none of his family that that's what he was doing. Nobody knew that's what he did on Sunday morning. He was coming to church every Sunday morning and to sit back at the church. And all the time there, he never took communion, never came forward. He would leave before the morning, mostly, I think about 6 minutes. And he occasionally would phone me and chat to me. And we made this partial connection to each other. He died about 3 weeks ago, and it was on a Saturday, Sunday morning. His family come walking in the back of the church. So his 40 sisters and brothers come, about 6 of them walk in, they want to come and see Father Simon. And they had discovered that this was what Bob was doing. And his last request was that he be buried from St. George's Martyr.
I'm going to cry.
Okay, yep. But I think there's something about Bob's story which says, here's a man who, for whom faith became very real in those last few months of his life, and very tangible, because he was seen to be one of the great, unwashed, disaffected, faithful. I mean, that's really what he wanted. But he was seeking a safe space where he could restore his faith and not get it shut down his throat as he'd done all the way through his childhood within that. And so for me, it's how do I create those spaces? How do I engage them? And the irony is that his family, he requested that whatever gifts were given at his funeral would be given to the church. So his financial contribution before he left was to us, saying that any gifts that anybody wanted to give, financial gifts they want to give, was to go to St. George Martin, be made up to the parish church. And, you know, I had 60 media people sitting there, all these people from the CBC and everywhere, all knew him, sitting at St. George's Martin for a funeral. One man just came in and sat quietly at the back of the church at 9 o'clock. So for me, it's what I do, how do I create those safe spaces where people can have those conversations with me and feel that they're valued and that somehow or other there's a connection that's going to be made for them around the sort of ultimate questions of life. Because I'm very explicit, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to be a creative community.
I wanted to revisit Minhas.
Oh, Minhas.
I've heard lots over the last few years about messages. I haven't come across the term Minhas.
Yeah, this is my fight back against messages.
That is a wonderful idea. We've also heard a little bit recently in the news about Old Table. Now, yeah. I see this as a compromise to an Open Table.
Yes.
I just wondered practically how you are approaching that, particularly if you're dealing with a non-religious community and trying to educate them and draw them into Christian faith.
Yeah.
How does that work?
This is evangelism by liturgical immersion. That's the
That's what I'm talking to doctors.
It is. And Father Al Butson's here, so you'll understand it. What's it all? I think the Romans have been doing a lot longer than we've ever been doing that, so it's nothing new.
Yeah.
It's from the Anglo-Catholic tradition as well, within Anglicanism. And Minimass started in the Diocese of York and was built upon what used to be known as the pram services, which you might remember.
Okay.
And the pram service was something that really came out after the war, and it was that came out of the now defunct Service of Reincorporation of Women. When women... In the Anglican Church, in the old prayer book, there's a service that you did for women who had given birth.
Okay.
And reincorporated into the life of the community, and it had to do with all sorts of mistaken notions of the farm, and all sorts of horrible things. But anyway, we definitely know you're going to use it.
It was
in the prayer book. I love the prayer book, but that's the prayer book. But it gave us a point of access, and that was in the press. In the pram services was to groups of mothers who were stay at homes and who wanted some form of connection. I mean, it's like coffee houses or coffee clubs in other Protestant traditions. But it was a liturgical service. It was based upon the Eucharist. So you would have these groups of new mothers with small children who would come to a set Eucharistic service during the week. And it was a way of reincorporating them into the life of the community of faith and the church. And often was effective in the sense that there were women who connected to the church through pram services who would otherwise not have been connected to the church in some form or other. In the Diocese of York, they reimagined that and called it Mini Mass. And Mini Mass, because there are so many young parents, not just mothers, who are part of parenting tots groups in England now, who take a year off, their primary engagement with the church is not on a Sunday, it's during the week. And so often these things happen like on a Thursday morning, it's very informal, you have, often sitting on a carpet. It's aimed at adults, not children, but incorporates children. And so that's a value set in our community, is that we're finding more and more parents who want to participate in the mystery of faith with their children and then realize that they can mentor faith for their children, even if they don't understand their faith themselves or their aspiration to engage with mystical is there. And that developed as a whole model of church in England, primarily during the week. When I was in Devon, we tried it on a Sunday morning in a small rural community because nothing used to happen on a Sunday. But we started with a moms and tots group that used to meet in the back of our church. And what we did was we offered them an 11:15 service, which was actually a fourth service of the day in that parish. And then it was followed by lunch. And the idea was to take Anglican liturgy divided up into four sections. So the gathering at the front end, up to the Gloria, then the colic, then the readings for that given Sunday from the lecture, then the prayers, the people, and the confessional, and then the actual communion part. And so what we did is, over a month, we would offer distinct units. So you would start with the gathering on the first Sunday of the month, second Sunday would be word, third Sunday would be prayer, fourth Sunday would be Eucharist. And it was all instructed. So we, because of the post-Christians, some of them second, third generation post-Christians, they had no Christian memory at all, they would come and we'd have to actually tell them what we were doing constantly and explain the world to them. It was very informal. It was informal and engaging. The sermons were not sermons, they were didactic conversations around the passage. And the Eucharist was open to the extent that people would come and gather around the table and we gave them the discretion to take or not. But it was always on the understanding that they needed to be informed in what they were doing. So it was constantly reinforced that this is what is happening. That's why we're doing it.
I had a conversation earlier with somebody who was talking about that the argument against open table is, particularly with things like children coming forward, is that they're too young to understand, they haven't grasped the concept. This person's argument was, in that case, we should stop taking communion to adults with dementia.
Yes.
And I thought, what a wonderful, wonderful argument against denying
I think that this is, I know it's not a theological debate, but I just want to say, I think that's where this whole idea of and, both and, comes into place again. Because I can argue for both sides of the story, too.
Yes.
But the truth of the matter is, every single bishop agreed that it should not be an open table. And for the actual, every single bishop to come to agreement, the Spirit must be moving in that. And so I think we have to be careful that just because we want to be more welcoming, that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, in a sense, because there is a way of engaging with community in a healthy way that respects that the Spirit did move at that conference of bishops. And then how do we engage in a real, true, faithful, trusting in God to work through the instruments. Like if someone came up and you didn't know whether or not they were baptized, you don't have to worry because God works through that. And I think that's kind of where we are in these kind of both and mentalities.
Be careful to say I'm not advocating on the table. By the way, but since you're so, I wouldn't say that before. and I'm being taken.
But being with the bathwater was a great climate in baptism.
Yes. No, but I mean, just tell you what we did in England. So it gives you a sense. Within 6 months, we had 60 regular worshippers who gathered. Our first baptism, we had 200 people at our first baptism, which was our first 6 months. So we made a direct link between the sacrament of baptism and Eucharist. So that theologically, we want to make that link. I think what I would do is I would use discretion in terms of I mean, I wouldn't put in the bulletin, you may not take communion here unless you're baptized, but I would definitely communicate constantly the relationship between the Eucharist and baptism as a theological link that needs to happen. And then leave it up to the discretion of the person taking to decide whether they fit that category or not. From there, I'm not people might wish us I've never the baptism please. So I might get a check out there once baptized. But in my own congregation now, I've made that quite explicit from the pulpit. But there is a link, and I teach on baptism constantly and what baptism means. And I think you're right. It is a point where you want to say to people, sometimes our theology is completely screwed. You know, so what if you're baptized and you're now entitled to take communion? Because that's the other possible problem.
Exactly.
And you want to say, no, actually, I should bar you from communion for this Sunday because you attitude and entitlement to it. But I think at the same time saying, no, there's a logical link between the two. What we are doing is we're aiming this primarily on a Saturday evening for disaffected faithful. And what we have in our context is a lot of disaffected Roman Catholics who have married to people from other denominational backgrounds and who come to us seeking something that looks Roman but is for Protestant. And so those are the people we're appealing to. And what we found out is that they're just too busy on a Sunday morning to come to church. Because they're Roman, they used to go on a Saturday evening. And so what we're trying to do is actually get it up on a Saturday evening. And the couple who were involved in the initial planting process, they're one of those couples. He's from a Roman background, and she was from a Brethren background, but has now become an Anglican. And so this is their compromise for them to be in our context. And so they have an appreciation of what we're doing. But in addition, many of them have disaffected because they're ethically upset with the church. And so they're looking for a community of faith that is ethically more open and engaged in conversation rather than presumptuous of who they are. So that's really where we've been. Yeah. And we'll face the question of baptism as well. But my response is that I deal with the pastoral, so I have those conversations with people pastorally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I still want to create that link. I do have colleagues who just ignore the diocesan policy. So, you know, I've never been in a diocese where this hasn't been policy. And I've served on three continents so far. But I think there's a question of, you know, I think you still want to do it with integrity, what you're doing, not just simply walk all over something. Because I think the theology is there for a reason. So I'm still, it's the same as I still do the creed every Sunday. And many mass still has a creed. It's still because people. I'm careful how I say this, but I'm going to say it nonetheless. I think there's a danger among some of my more liberal colleagues that fresh expressions is theologically open-ended and weak. It's not true. I think fresh expressions is a strong call back to orthodoxy. On some level or other, but in a context where there's this constant conversation, theological conversation around ethics and theology. And so I think that what I'm seeing is really the folk who we attract are people who want something of substance, who are not necessarily the people who are going to go, well, I won't say that because I don't believe it. But I do have people who will say, I'm struggling to say that because I'm struggling to believe it, but nonetheless, I'll come. I have a confirmation group at the moment of young adults now preparing for confirmation, and that's the key to that conversation.
I find people like that are often my best volunteers.
Yes.
Because they want to get similar.
That's right, yeah. And so these are people who want to come because they want to be involved in the conversation, but they want to do so under integrity and respect. They don't want just me to say, oh, it doesn't matter, because it does matter to them.